Chapter 40, Political Victory. In the late 1970s, I laid the foundations of a political apparatus, enlisting hundreds of local people dedicated to our principles. In 1979, I ran against a strong incumbent, Joe Thiemann, for the Louisiana State Senate and received 26% of the vote, a good base from which to work. I continued to travel the nation, rallying our people to stand up for their rights and heritage. In 1988, I traveled the country, running in Democratic presidential primaries, much like George Wallace once did. In the New Hampshire primary, I campaigned for the Democratic vice presidential nomination and won the primary with 60% of the vote. Although not a strongly contested nomination, it proved that people would vote for my ideals if given the opportunity. I believe that the American people were so desperate for someone to stand up for them that the media attacks on me as a racist would backfire. I did a half-hour paid television show, which aired in markets around America as well as in New Orleans. I scored 26,000 votes in Louisiana, exceeding the totals of some of the main contenders for the nomination for the presidency of the United States. Later in that year, I won the nomination of the Populist Party for president and campaigned across America, receiving 150,000 votes on Election Day. In the Louisiana presidential primary, I came in ahead of several of the major candidates. In some areas, I received vote totals exceeding those of mainstream Democratic candidates such as Al Gore, Gary Hart, Paul Simon, and Dick Gebhardt. The Times-Picayune, attempting to downplay my good showing, listed my vote totals as other. For example, the vote totals in St. Bernard Parish, an adjacent parish east of New Orleans, had Gebhardt 13%, Gore 6%, Simon 1%, Hart 7%, and other at 17%. The other vote category was almost entirely my votes. My campaign workers became angered that a candidate such as Senator Paul Simon of Illinois, with only 1%, was listed, but I, with 17%, was designated as other. Such blatant media distortion is used to keep people unaware that there are significant numbers of people who will support political candidates who stand up for the rights of European Americans. The media operates by one of the oldest and most reliable advertising principles, namely that the most important factor is not how good or bad your product is, but whether people think it's popular. The press still does everything it can to portray me as unpopular, hoping that doing so will make me unpopular. One can see the same underlying principle at work in the schoolyard when children tend to like those that the popular kids do and dislike those the popular kids don't. In 1988, I traveled to Cincinnati and sought the populist nomination under the leadership of Willis Cardo and Don Wassell. I won it over two major contenders, Democrat Congressman Jim Traficant of Ohio and retired Colonel Beau Gritz. The next 2 months led me to many states where I used every opportunity to speak for the rights and heritage of the European American. In the end, the Populist Party, under my presidential campaign, won 150,000 votes nationwide, a total that far exceeded other third parties who had more campaign funds than did our party. The grueling travel and campaigning had exhausted me, but I learned a lot. Talking with thousands of people, the length and breadth of the nation, I knew that most European Americans down deep believe in the same things that I do. Every poll had shown that more than 80% of the people oppose affirmative action. They oppose forced busing for integration, and they oppose the third world immigration invasion. It was true that many do not know the scientific facts of race, but the overwhelming majority clearly want to live among their own kinsmen and live in a society representing the values and the culture of Western mankind. European Americans make that clear by whom they choose to associate with. They also have a vision of America that's radically different than the multicultural nightmare promoted by the media. But our people simply have not been given a voice. What really holds back candidates who are openly pro-European American is the media-instilled psychology of defeat. People are told it's useless to vote for a white rights advocate because he has no chance to win. Basically, whites are told repeatedly that they are alone and unpopular in their beliefs. It became clear to me that the soft underbelly of American politics is on the local level. Because on that level, through personal contact, a sincere candidate can overcome disproportionate campaign spending and media bias. If a candidate participates in debates and forums and knocks on enough doors, his message can be powerful, as effective as he can present himself on a person-to-person level. It became clear to me that once a candidate passes a visible threshold of support and people believe that his winning is possible, then it becomes possible. I also learned that the psychology of victory becomes easier under the banner of a major party. Up until that year, I had been a George Wallace-style Democrat, but the Democratic Party's Marxist and vocal minority elements made it impossible for me to remain in the Democrat Party any longer, even superficially. I could not remain in the party of Jesse Jackson and Michael Dukakis. I received the nomination and ran as the Populist Party candidate for president as a means of building the populist movement and to increase the racial awareness of the American people. But the only real victory made possible by running in such a race is not the office itself, but the winning of the hearts and minds of millions of Americans. To get elected, cognizant of the realities of American politics, it is necessary to go through one of the major parties. Although the Republican Party leadership has also sold out our European American heritage, whites have overwhelmingly shifted to Republican because the Democratic Party has become an even worse alternative. Millions of whites have joined the Republican Party because they are under the impression that the Republicans will defend the traditional heritage of America. As a note here for this taped edition, of course, the Republican Party has presided over many, many years of the decline of the American Republic and the American European American majority, the same, perhaps even worse, than the Democratic rule over our society. There's been no real difference. Although Republican leaders don't want to admit it, racial issues propel the Republican Party in the South. For instance, the first great Southern breakthrough of the Republican Party in the 1960s came with the candidacy of Senator Barry Goldwater, who had defiantly voted against the Civil Rights Act. Nixon and Reagan frequently talked about white issues such as forced busing, welfare abuse, crime, and affirmative action, all of which had clear racial components. But once in office, the Republicans did not act on these issues, and in fact, under both Nixon and Reagan, forced busing, welfare, minority crime, and affirmative action all increased dramatically. In the end, many whites migrated to the Republican Party for the same reasons they had immigrated to the suburbs. They were more comfortable among their own kind. The Democratic Party had become a party of every conceivable special interest group, assorted racial minorities, radical feminists, homosexuals, far-left types, etc. They simply view the Democratic Party as not of their own kind, and they see Republicans as the lesser of two evils. No matter how one might wish it otherwise, the American political structure is organized on a two-party basis. There is not one member of the U.S. Senate in America who is not a member of one of the two main parties. Obviously, America has a wide range of political thought. However, the fact that only two parties control practically all the representation in government shows the built-in bias of the system. almost all other democratic nations have multi-party systems with a much wider range of political thought. The one redeeming factor of the two-party system is that because the parties are omnipresent, they are viewed as public entities that must allow anyone to participate. There's no legal or political prescription. There's no litmus test of your principles to join or participate in either Democrat or Republican party. Anyone can run as a Democrat or Republican in most races for public office. It is a right that the parties find very uncomfortable. Even though I served as an elected Republican legislator, I was denied even the right to put my name on the ballot for the Republican presidential nomination in some states. I was able to prevail in the federal courts, but I did not win the decision until several months after the election. The old adage that in America anyone has the right to run for president is rapidly becoming obsolete. Running under the banner of a major party gives one a lot more credibility than running as a third-party candidate, and thus is important for developing the all-important winning psychology. Everyone takes it for granted that only a Democrat or a Republican can win. So when someone runs as a third-party candidate, it hurts the candidate's credibility. I believe that when a successful European-American third party does rise in America, which I think will occur in the first decades of the 21st century, it will emerge out of one of the major parties, likely the Republican Party. There is no barrier within the major parties that can prevent patriots from organizing within it, for example, as America First Republicans, and building a true grassroots movement inside the party apparatus. Even an official third-party movement and organization can get involved with a major party unofficially and thus learn the mechanics of the election process. Next section is election victory. In the fall of 1988, Chuck Cusimano II, a member of the Louisiana House of Representatives from my home district 81 in Metairie, Louisiana, was elected to a judgeship, leaving his seat open. John Treen, chairman of the Republican Party in Jefferson Parish and the brother of a former Republican governor, Dave Treen, looked to go into the office easily. Even though Treen had the machinery of the Republican Party behind him, the open seat attracted a number of major local candidates, including school board member Delton Charles, who had the support of the most powerful politician in the parish of Jefferson, Lawrence Shahardy, the tax assessor. Another major candidate was Democrat D.J. Bud Allister, who had the support of the popular Chinese-American sheriff of Jefferson Parish, and that's Harry Lee. Because of the frequent black robberies occurring in white neighborhoods, Lee acquired a national racist reputation when he ordered his deputies to stop dilapidated old cars driven by black teenagers in all-white neighborhoods. He was also in hot water with the press for trying to put up barricades on streets linking black Orleans Parish and white Jefferson Parish. After conferring with my longtime friend Howie Farrell and other friends and supporters, I registered Republican and decided to enter the election. A total of 7 hard-working, full-time candidates campaigned for the seat. In my race for office, I did not modify my rhetoric other than to emphasize those issues that were pertinent to the district's voters. I spoke strongly against affirmative action and the massive discrimination against whites, the high illegitimate welfare birth rate that was destroying our economy and causing the productive to become outnumbered and outvoted. I dared to speak about the minority crime that was reducing our streets to barbarism and the fact that we needed at least one man in the legislature who would stand up for us, just as the black legislators do for their own people. Only then could we change the direction of government. I had limited funds, but as always, I made them go far, writing and composing my own campaign literature and even working with the printers to fold, print, mail my own letters to the voters. I hit the streets from early morning until 10 or 11 at night. I attended every political forum and was well prepared and confident at each one. I won the overwhelming support of the crowds at the candidate debates. With each new forum, the psychology of my supporters began to change as they saw my broad-based support. And in those cheers of the crowd, they realized that they were not alone in backing me. The district had thousands, making it impossible for me to knock on every door, so I decided to work first the homes and the businesses on the main roads. Many residents gave me permission to put up campaign yard signs on their front lawns. As soon as I had enough sound sign commitments for a good showing, a dozen volunteers and I worked all night for 3 nights putting up signs all over the district. When people awoke to a sea of blue and white Duke signs, not just on public property but on voters' lawns, it had a dramatic effect on the psychology of the voters. Suddenly, it became fashionable to support me. Each new sign going up had a compound effect. It enabled others who secretly supported me to become braver and begin talking to their friends about me or order a sign themselves. Soon we had more signs in people's yards than all the other candidates combined. A large amount of visible support was critically important to my campaign. People needed the reinforcement. Howie Farrell had suggested that I use a plain blue sign with reversed out letters in white with a small lettered David, a big lettered Duke, and a small lettered state representative. My signs stood out, and their location on the main thoroughfares made them seem even more numerous. It took large sums of money and a lot of time to keep the signs up. Our enemies would often tear them down the same night that we erected them. We lost thousands of signs, but we also discovered that many were taken by supporters who wanted them for their own yards or by teenagers wanting them for their rooms. Hundreds of Duke signs even began appearing in yards far from the district. On election day of the first primary, with the top two vote-getters going into a runoff, I received 33% of the vote. The next closest candidate was John Treen with 19%. When I ran first, the last barrier of defeatism that held me back evaporated. Many of the people in my district realized that for the first time in their voting life, they could actually vote for someone who represented their own viewpoint. For the first time, someone was saying out loud what people say in the privacy of their homes or among their friends. People got excited. Many middle-aged people told me that they believed their vote for me was the most important one they'd ever cast in their lives. The Times-Picayune also realized that I had a real chance to win. They couldn't label my first-place victory in the primary as other this time. The newspaper and the power structure went into a frenzy. Their treatment of me went from the silent treatment to an all-out personal assault. Pictures of me at age 19 picketing William Kunstler and photographs of me in Klan robes flooded every home of the district by direct mail and were shown repeatedly in the media. Tens of thousands of Jewish dollars poured into the Treen campaign, and the Times-Picayune went into a tirade against me, which still recurrently flares up to this day. A radical Jew by the name from New York by the name of Mordecai Levy of the Jewish Defense Organization came down to New Orleans to hold rallies against me. He upset the local Jewish leaders because they knew that the people of my district were not well disposed to New York Jews coming into Metairie to tell them how to vote. Certainly the local left-wing Jewish groups wanted to tell the people of my district how to vote, but not so overtly. Levy promised that the Jews would stop me and destroy my campaign by any means necessary, even if it took bloodshed. In a satellite hookup from New York, the New Orleans ABC affiliate WVUE-TV interviewed Levy by a live hookup on the 6 o'clock evening news. When Levy thought the live interview was over and the microphone was turned off, he told the reporter that the people of Metairie were, quote, asshole, idiot, white devils. By a fortuitous technical glitch, the feed was still live on the air when he said it, and the people of Metairie heard loud and clear what my Jewish antagonists really thought of them. The good people of my district were appalled. Advertisements attacking me as a Nazi, a Klansman, a racist, an anti-Semite saturated TV, radio, and newspapers. Jewish organizations making sensational charges against me filled the local newscasts. Jewish money poured into Treen's war chest, and dozens of Jewish students from Tulane knocked on the doors of my district tearfully telling the voters that electing me would be equivalent to another Holocaust. The Jews leaned on practically every elected official in Louisiana, whether Republican or Democrat, to denounce me and endorse John Treen, even liberal Democrats. Jewish leaders became so desperate that they put out the damnable lie that I was somehow even anti-Christian and anti-Catholic. My district was 65% Catholic. To me, that was the ultimate hypocrisy, the most virulently anti-Christian group since the time of Christ had the chutzpah to viciously smear me as anti-Christian. They had no shame. They even put pressure on the very respected Catholic Archbishop of New Orleans, Philip Hannon, to write a statement to be read in the mass of every Catholic church in the district. It read, quote, "The election will determine the convictions of the voters of the district about the basic dignity of persons, recognition of human rights of every person, and the equality of races made by divine providence." The church's reading of the statement during the Lenten season, the holiest time of year for Catholics, was expected to make a great impact. But courageously, a number of brave Catholics arose from their pews and protested the reading, saying it was wrong to bring politics into the church. Catholics who supported me became so upset that the Archbishop ultimately backtracked a bit and issued a statement reading, quote, "At no time have I stated either verbally or in writing that I support either of the candidates." Harry Farrell, my campaign manager and a devout Catholic, pointed out in a letter to the Archbishop that not a single anti-Catholic writing or utterance by me had ever been produced by my detractors. As the election neared, my enemies knew, just as I did, that victory in this one small race would have ramifications far beyond District 81. White people would be emboldened to speak out across America, maybe even around the world. As the stakes got larger, the traditional enemy pulled out all the stops. They had President George Bush write a letter to the district voters discussing the crucial importance of this election. Of course, the reason that a small House race in Louisiana became crucial to the President of the United States was because it was seen as critically important by the Jewish power structure around him. Ronald Reagan did radio commercials telling people to vote for his friend, John Treen. Under intense pressure, almost every state representative came out against me. Every state senator, every U.S. congressman and U.S. senator in Louisiana, and from many neighboring states, the governor and lieutenant governor, the heads of the Chamber of Commerce, the Archbishop, many Protestant ministers, as well as coaches, sports heroes, Hollywood actors, and the President and Vice President of the United States, and a number of former presidents. I frequently said on my speeches, the only one who didn't show up to oppose me was the Ayatollah Khomeini, and the only reason he didn't was because he was dead. On election day, thousands of people came out in the streets to demonstrate for me. People spontaneously decorated their cars in support of my campaign and paraded around all day long by the hundreds, flashing their lights and blowing horns. ABC News correspondent Mike Von Fremd expressed amazement to me as he watched this show of incredible support. He said, "You know, you could win an election for the U.S. Senate if it were not for your Klan background." After watching the euphoria for another few minutes, he added, "No, I think you could win anyway." The turnout was 78% of the registered voters, which is about every voter in a district who had not moved away or died. It was the highest turnout in Louisiana history for a House race. Howie Farrell and I went to the first parish courthouse in Metairie for the tabulation. It was back and forth through the evening until finally I pulled ahead and won with 8,459 votes to Train's 8,232. Howie was jubilant, and I sat there in disbelief for a moment. I went to make a payphone call to my father and then my mother. I was never more proud in my life than at that moment I gave them the news. On the way to the election party, everyone in the car listened to the election coverage and cheered or booed the commentator's remarks. I thought about all the abuse I had taken over the years for my beliefs. That one moment of victory made it all worthwhile. It was a brilliant new could inspire many more across America, perhaps even for years to come. If I could win such a race in the highest educated district of Louisiana, with my opponents showing a picture of me from my youth with a swastika, and for more recent years in Klan robes, if I could overcome what many would say was the political kiss of death, then great opportunities existed for others who simply espoused my beliefs without having had my controversial past. Of course, the fact that my past was controversial propelled the election coverage and made me the best-known state legislator in America. I proved that it's possible to overcome great odds when one has the power of the truth and faith in the power of the truth. The truth can be beaten down for a while, but it will find victory if only we will relentlessly stand up for it. A forest of satellite dishes and blinding lights greeted Howie and me at the victory party at the Lions Club on Metairie Road. Hundreds of cheering supporters waited outside in the chilly night, and inside the small hall was jammed wall to wall with ecstatic people. I mounted the podium and gave a short speech that I could hardly finish for the roars of the crowd. Then I went out into the cold to greet the people who couldn't fit into the hall. I climbed onto the trunk of a car and spoke to them as well. Here's what I told them. I had to come out here to be with you too, out in the cold, for this is what this campaign has been all about. The fact that the founding elements of this country, many of the men and women whose ancestors built America, are now out in the cold of affirmative action. Many are out in the cold by not being able to send their children to the very schools paid for by their own taxes. We are braving the cold tonight because we have a vision for America, a vision of being able to walk on our own streets without fear, being able to use our schools, and having equal rights for all in America, not special privilege for a few. We share a vision of truly helping the poor by reforming the welfare system that has only fueled illegitimacy and increased drugs and poverty and crime. We demand an America based on merit. We are dedicated to our children striving toward excellence in a society based on the best of our heritage. And my friends, we will not let our heritage be sacrificed on the altar of multiculturalism. You great people will not be in the cold too long. Next time we meet, we'll exchange greetings in the great warm house that Huey Long built, the State House of Representatives in Baton Rouge. The next few days alternated between heaven and hell. We had heard that our opponents were determined to take away illegally what they could not accomplish in the election. An attempt was made to challenge the length of time I had lived in the district and thus invalidate my candidacy and void the election. The clerk of court had already certified the election, and after a court battle, a judge had validated my victory. But still, my opponents decided to challenge it in the legislature itself to try to have a special investigation to prevent me from being sworn into office. The law on residency was very specific. It gave those who contested the candidate's qualifications for office a specific length of time to file a complaint. Once the deadline expired, there was no opportunity for challenge. Of course, the law did not stop my opponents, who had no qualms about holding me to a different standard than every other elected official in the state. The legislature finally put the challenge to a vote, and I prevailed. When I was finally sworn in, the world watched it live on CNN. Even though George Bush, Vice President Dan Quayle, and Lee Atwater, National Chairman of the Republican Party, denounced me, I was treated quite well by the Republican delegation. I was accepted as a full member of the delegation in the House of Representatives, and my name was included on the masthead of the monthly delegation newsletter. Members of the delegation supported all my proposed legislation, just as I supported theirs. Over the next 3 years, I amassed a perfect Republican voting record, and I was still an official member of the Republican delegation when George Bush endorsed the liberal Democrat candidate J. Bennett Johnston for the U.S. Senate. Later, he endorsed the flamboyantly corrupt liberal Democrat Edwin Edwards against me for the governorship. Not only did Bush betray me as a fellow Republican, but by hurting me, he also hurt the political chances of all the Republican candidates statewide, because by undermining the head of the ticket in the state, he undermined every Republican. As a freshman candidate and representative, I offered a series of groundbreaking pieces of legislation. Among a number of issues, I authored legislation that proposed, 1, the outlawing of affirmative action by forbidding any affirmative action program that discriminates against better qualified whites in jobs, promotions, scholarships, college admissions, or the awarding of contracts. 2, the mandatory use of birth control, such as NorPlant, by welfare mothers as a condition of welfare assistance. They had the freedom to have all the illegitimate children that they wanted. They just did not have the right to make the taxpayer pay for them. And 3, the mandatory drug testing of welfare recipients and residents of public housing, and the removal from welfare rolls if they tested positive. If we could drug test people who work for a living and pay taxes, then why not require welfare recipients to stay off drugs before they get a check from the hard-working people? I also co-authored bills for workfare instead of welfare, stronger penalties for rape and murder, and greater protections of Louisiana's wetlands and environment. Although it was hard to get these bills through committee, my vote and speeches on many bills and amendments had an impact on a great deal of legislation, and the Republican delegation did support me on my specific bills. Also, my presence made other Republicans mimic my legislative proposals. For instance, Republican Senator Ben Baggert, who planned to run for the U.S. Senate against me, proposed a comprehensive welfare, workfare bill that I co-authored and the House passed. One of the first welfare reform bills passed in the nation was that bill. The governor, a conservative Democrat named Buddy Romer, ran on a no-tax increase program, saying that if any tax increase raised its ugly head, he would chop it off. Just as George Bush's "Read My Lips, No New Taxes" quote on the national level, Romer now proposed the most massive tax increase in the history of the state of Louisiana. The increased tax was one of the reasons why Romer had supported my opponent, John Treen, who had promised to go along with his proposed tax increase. Because the tax amendment was constitutional in its scope, it had to win both the majority of the voters as well as 2/3 of the legislature. Not only was I against the bill for tax reasons, it also included a minority set-aside provision, anti-white discrimination, included in it to garner the support of the legislature's black caucus. The amendment passed the legislature easily, and the polls looked as though it would easily win approval in the election. I met with Assessor Lawrence Shahardi of Jefferson Parish, and we publicly joined forces in opposing the bill throughout the state. With his power in Jefferson and my support throughout North Louisiana, we set out to defeat the tax bill. I traveled the state day and night for 3 weeks leading up to the vote. The proponents of the tax, mostly big business, were spending millions on ad campaigns, while the small and medium-sized businessmen of the state and the working people had only a small media budget. The core of our effort was my statewide schedule of public speeches and news interviews against the proposal. As the governor and I crisscrossed the state debating the tax issue, we knew our paths would cross again in the future politically. In Shreveport and elsewhere across the state, I drew much larger crowds than Governor Romer. In his hometown of Shreveport, I spoke to students and working people, drawing cheers at the university, while Romer talked to the fat cats across town. The Shreveport Journal headlined, "Duke outdraws Romer." All Romer could say was, "I don't care what David Duke and the American Nazi Party have to say about the tax election." Nasty as ever, he was. On election night at the Electrical Union Hall in Metairie, with 300 supporters, a keg of beer, and no band, we waited for the results. It was quite a contrast to the proponents' champagne parties in the swankiest hotels of the state. But when the returns came in, after challenging the governor and his big money head-on, we had won. The voters overwhelmingly rejected the measure. Reporters crowded around me as I said that the voters had spoken clearly. They reject any new taxes, and they reject the anti-white racism called set-asides. The Senate race. In early 1990, the time seemed right to press our advantage. Senator J. Bennett Johnston was up for re-election. An 18-year incumbent, Johnston was the epitome of the career politician. When it had been politically smart to do so in the South, he opposed integration and even filed suit in opposition to it. But as the climate changed and the media power became clear, he went along with the entire liberal program. Hypocritically, in spite of his segregationist past, he criticized me for my racist and bigoted past. Although he had an image of a conservative Democrat, he had a voting record that Ted Kennedy would have been proud of. In fact, in some surveys, only Kennedy of the entire U.S. Senate had a more liberal voting record. Johnston had betrayed the South and the European majority countless times in everything from affirmative action to subservience to Israel. I believed he was vulnerable, even though the first major poll for the Baton Rouge Morning Advocate showed him defeating me 60-23%. I knew that I had to run now and run hard because the powerful forces in the media and the government establishment would eventually wear down some of my public support. State Senator Ben Baggert garnered the Republican official nomination as a foregone conclusion because of the structure of the Republican convention, which was heavily weighted by insiders. But Louisiana has an open primary system, which means that anyone of either party could run in the first primary, and if no one had a majority, the top two vote-getters would then be in the runoff for the Senate. It was a good situation for me because I was confident that I could significantly outpoll Baggert, and Johnston would then be forced into a runoff. Once any incumbent senator is in a runoff, he is vulnerable to defeat, as the challenger has a strong psychological edge. As I traveled the state, my campaign drew tremendous support. People came out and supported me, even though the newspapers had hammered at me for more than a year. The Jewish-controlled media accused me of being un-American, bigoted, unprincipled, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, hateful, and financially corrupt. They evoked just about any personal attack that could have been imagined, and they did it day after day, week after week. But the people knew that I really wanted the same things that they did. In promoting multiculturalism, the media created a false version of the world. To make multiculturalism more fashionable, they pretend everybody's really for it. In reality, European Americans are deeply dissatisfied with the direction of the country, but they desperately need those who will stand up and tell them the truth. They must know that they're not alone. I stood up and I said in public what most people had already said in their private conversations. The media repeatedly told them that my sentiments were unpopular, held only by a few backward and bigoted people. But when people came to my rallies or saw them on TV, they realized that thousands of others shared their own views. They discovered that most of their friends and relatives believe just as they do, and just as I do. Probably the greatest support I received was from a man I had long admired since I was a teenager, Willis Cardo. He helped me with mail fundraising. We raised about $2.4 million in the race, and were outspent about 3-1 by Bennett Johnston and other anti-Duke forces. Also, because we had to raise our money in small amounts in the mail and by expensively advertised rallies, it cost us far more to raise our $2.4 million than the cost-free donations of the big PACs. So we could spend only a tiny fraction of what our opponents spent in vital campaigning activities such as media advertisements. Unlike the Johnston campaign, mine had extremely few large contributors. I had to use mass mailings and public meetings. If it cost my campaign $50,000 to do a mailing and postage and preparation fees, I might get back only $75,000 in contributions, sometimes even less. So although I raised $75,000 in funds, only $25,000 additional was available for the use of signs, advertising, and other means we had to solicit voters. The same principle held true for public meetings. To hold one, we had to rent the facility, hire a band, pay for catering, extensively advertise. We were lucky if the event broke even. Our supporters could not afford $1,000 and most not even $100 for a $100 per plate dinner. Instead, we had free events. If we had a dinner, it was more likely to be the $20 red beans and rice. If I spent $3,000 for an event, the event certainly raised the total of my campaign funds, but it would often cost more to put on the event than the money I raised from it. Of course, the functions were great for inspiring and organizing our people, but they raised little money for television advertising. As for the news coverage, every major daily in the state came out for Johnston and frequently ran extremely biased articles against my candidacy. Every article carefully repeated my Klan past like it was part of my given name, even though every person in Louisiana was already aware of it. Almost every article introduced me as ex-Ku Klux Klansman David Duke, and most of those I read left out any mention of my official title as state representative. I attracted 10 times the number of individual contributions than did the 18-year incumbent I challenged, but the contributions came from my many middle-class supporters and were small, while the contributions from his few but affluent supporters were large. My small contributions came from the middle class. His large contributions came from the special interests expecting to get back a good return for their investment. Additionally, my Jewish antagonists formed several groups against me, such as the Coalition Against Racism and Nazism and the Louisiana Coalition, more than 90% financed by Jews. Every time the media covered an event, their slander squad members were there to give extensive interviews. Whereas most speeches and campaign stops by Johnston were simply reported in the media, almost every report of my stops centered about charges made by the radicals who followed me around. The media were happy to oblige them with lavish publicity. Often one or two Jewish opponents who came to my rallies were given twice the airtime of my speech and the hundreds or thousands of supporters who were in attendance. The most effective of my opponents' tactics was economic blackmail. Even if you like Duke and agree with him, the argument went, you can't vote for him because if you do, you won't be able to feed your family. They threatened the people of my state with predictions that the Pentagon would close the state's Army and Air Force military bases, such as the Air Force base in Alexandria, Louisiana. Also, they asserted that our state would lose important federal projects, such as the proposed Super Collider project, as well as a U.S. Navy shipbuilding contract at Avondale Shipyards. I used what little advertising money I had on producing and promoting a 30-minute campaign television program in which I asked people to call in a pledge for my campaign. The programs were a great success. People enjoyed hearing someone talk openly about the issues they truly cared about, issues no other candidate would raise. And by the way, you can still get copies of those programs from our office in Mandeville, care of our website. Despite the economic blackmail and the media's incessant character assassination, it looks certain that we were heading for a runoff with Bennett Johnston. Then a bombshell exploded. With only 1 week left until Election Day, the official Republican-endorsed candidate, Ben Baggert, dropped out of the race and endorsed Johnston, an unprincipled act of betrayal to the people of my state and even his own voters. He withdrew so close to Election Day that his name could not be removed from the ballots, and all those who had voted for him absentee, a sizable number, who would have probably become my voters, lost their votes. Baggert's withdrawal assured Johnston of a victory in the first primary. When Johnston's entourage heard the news of Baggert's withdrawal, they stopped their Winnebago caravan on the shoulder of a North Louisiana highway, broke out champagne, and danced with joy. Johnston and the media predicted a landslide victory for Bennett Johnston. Lance Hill, the former pro-Viet Cong seditionist who was head of the Committee Against Nazism and Racism, predicted my smashing defeat. Instead, I garnered 44% of the vote to Johnston's 54%. Only Baggert's withdrawal prevented a runoff election, and thus a good chance that I won a Senate seat in the United States of America. Hill said, quote, "The election was a referendum on hate, and hate won," unquote. In a way, Hill was right. The media and the powerful Jewish minority that so hated me and the American way of life that I stand for, they had won. I had lost, along with my voters, the best educated, hardest working people in the state. I received over 60% of the white vote statewide, the overwhelming majority of welfare recipients, drug addicts, criminals, and illiterates voted for my opponent. Yet the media prattle on about how the good people of the state prevailed in the race. On the positive side, the vote I received sent a message that reverberated across America. Hundreds of candidates from coast to coast said to themselves, if David Duke can receive that kind of support because of a stand for the European American, despite his controversial background, and despite overwhelming media opposition and being dramatically outspent, maybe I can use his issues effectively. The very next year, Senator Jesse Helms, for the first time in any of his campaigns, used opposition to anti-white affirmative action to win re-election in a tightly contested North Carolina race. After the race, many people began to talk to me about the race for governor that was coming up the following year. The enemies of our heritage now knew that I was stronger than ever and that I posed the most serious political threat to them in many decades in the United States. They were determined to use every resource at their disposal to end that threat. Trials and tribulations is the next section. As soon as I was elected to the House of Representatives, I read Jewish publications referring to me as, quote, a budding Hitler, and as the most dangerous threat to Jewish interests in the entire world. I began to feel the harsh effects of Jewish power more than ever. This volume is not intended as a detailed refutation of the many allegations of my enemies against me. To properly refute all the false smears and lies would require an entire volume by itself, and a pretty boring one at that. This book is about what I believe and how I came to believe it. But at the same time, it's vital for the reader to understand how our traditional enemy uses character assassination against all effective leaders for our cause. Soon after my election to the House, I honored a previous speaking engagement to the Populist Party in Chicago. In the reception area after my speech, a man I did not know and had never met before innocently approached me, greeting me, and shook my hand. Suddenly, a half-dozen photographers' flashbulbs popped off, and I was informed that the man himself was the flamboyant head of the Nazi Party in Chicago. It was just what the media wanted. And they reprinted the photo all over the nation and, of course, blanketed the state of Louisiana with it. It's almost impossible to defend oneself against that kind of smear. Look, the argument went, Duke is a Nazi. Here he is meeting and greeting the head of the American Nazi Party. After the incident, one veteran legislator told me that when I was first elected, I could have been elected to any office in Louisiana, but after that picture on the front page of every Louisiana paper, I might not be. It also made me appear as dishonest. So when I said to voters that I wasn't a National Socialist and so forth in my life, it made me look like I was simply lying to get elected, which is not an attractive trait for any elected official. My opponents began to run repeated exposés on me. Jewish groups even had a Holocaust exhibit brought into the lobby of the state capitol and placed not far from my desk in the hallway. And this was to combat what they alleged was the growing racial hatred in the state since my election. They sent elderly Jewish women with news cameras in tow to cry in anguish for my insensitivity to the Holocaust. I had a bookstore in Metairie for years, and my enemies visited the NAAWP headquarters and obtained some old books exposing Jewish supremacism from one of my volunteers, and then announced that I was selling anti-Semitic books from my legislative office. They tried to imply that I had inappropriately used my state-financed office to sell books and anti-Semitic books at that. In fact, Louisiana gives only a small stipend for an office and expects almost every legislator's office to be located in his normal business offices or connected to them. And they all are. My opponents showed up at every function to dog me and counter every word that I said to the press. The Times-Picayune employed a sleazy journalistic character assassin, Tyler Bridges, who would ingratiate himself with my supporters and then selectively use whatever they had to say to make my supporters and me look disreputable. His nearly full-time assignment was to dig up any dirt he could on my associates or me. He later wrote a book after interviewing hundreds of people, but interestingly enough, although I received over 60% of the white vote, he somehow could not find anyone of stature that had much good to say about me. His later marriage to his black girlfriend might suggest the temper of his bias against me. Practically every story the Times-Picayune paper ran about me, and there were many dozens during those years, intentionally put some sort of slant on the article to make me look stupid, inept, corrupt, sinister, or deceitful. During one campaign, they ran an utterly false hearsay story that I had used cocaine once in Colorado. Another time, again with not a shred of corroborating evidence, Bridges repeated a tabloid press allegation from a prostitute who claimed I had a liaison with her years before. Not surprisingly, he failed to mention in his book that she also had alleged that the CIA had planted transmitters in her head and that space aliens had abducted her a few times. Another story implied that I had never held a job, knowing full well that I have worked hard all my life. They implied that I was a womanizer. They wrote about a classified ad placed for my organization in a homosexual publication, which my group, by the way, did not place or authorize, implying that I could be homosexual. In my television broadcast, I pointed out jokingly that if I'm both a homosexual and a womanizer, then I must be very, very busy. They implied I was a draft dodger when they knew how much I wanted to be a military officer and have a career in the U.S. Army, and that I was outstanding ROTC cadet at LSU. Unlike Bill Clinton, who went to Britain and supported America's communist enemies, I had supported the American war effort as an instructor in Laos during the conflict. They assembled every quotation, accurate or not, from my past that made me look hateful or unintelligent and kept repeating them to the public. The fact that I repaired my nose that had been severely broken on a number of occasions became a, quote, facelift and plastic surgery to make me look more Aryan, unquote. They suggested I was getting rich from my election campaigns, but knew full well that I came out of every election campaign in personal debt. 3 days before the election for governor, November 13, 1991, the Times-Picayune, a thoroughly anti-Christian, Jewish-owned newspaper, ran a story headlined across the top of the front page. Quote, "Religious Leaders Doubt Duke's Christianity," written by Mr. Schleifstein. The charges were vicious and never-ending. Most often, the public would never even hear my answers to the incessant charges. The Times-Picayune published only 4 of my letters in response to many dozens of unprincipled attacks against me. One leftist reporter, Jason Berry, stooped so low in a column as to allege that I had once tried to, quote, "set my mother on fire," unquote. It was a story based on a tale told by a black housekeeper long after Pinky, who had worked for our family a short while until Mother fired her for stealing. No charge, no allegation, no smear was too base for my opponents. What frustrated me was that the media could say the most terrible things about me to thousands of people who were unlikely even to hear my side of the story. One day, as an experiment, I had a secretary blot out my name in a long smear article against me, and I pretended that I was an uninformed reader. By the time I finished the piece, I thought to myself, this guy is a real jerk, and the story was about me. The experience made me much more forgiving of people who believed only the worst about me. Sometimes people would ask me, if the stories are not true, why don't you sue? Those people are completely unaware of how the libel laws in America allow the press to practically say anything they want to about a public figure, correct or not, with little recourse. Also, it's practically impossible for a middle-income public figure to successfully sue the major media entities with their million-dollar legal staffs. A person alleged to be a, quote, white racist would have little luck anyway, given the minority makeup of so many of our courts. Even though I had to learn to accept smears as simply facts of life, they still sometimes took their toll. Some personal attacks, of course, also have a bit of truth in them. There have certainly been times when I have spoken intemperately or made a mistake in judgment. There have certainly been times when I have failed someone whom I loved. But when one dares to challenge those that Christ called the fathers of the lie, every human failing, whether real or imagined, will be magnified 100-fold. Over the years, I have come to expect such attacks and borne them with the knowledge that I must endure them, far more because of my virtues than because of my faults. The intensity of the personal attacks that the alien media masters level upon a white activist directly corresponds with how much they fear his effectiveness. In addition to yellow journalism, the establishment has many other means to harass its opponents in addition to the press. When I was elected to the House of Representatives, Dan Quayle announced that, quote, "we have ways of taking care of David Duke." Within months of my election, I received notice of my first extensive IRS audits. My attorney inquired as to the source of the request for an audit, and they admitted it came from outside the agency itself. While I was in office fighting the governor's tax amendment and getting ready to run for the U.S. Senate, I suddenly faced an exhaustive every scrap of documentation audit. Because I knew the government was anxious to discredit and perhaps even jail me if it could, I had to engage competent and expensive legal counsel and accountants, which posed a terrible financial burden. After years of audits and procedures, the auditors found no criminal wrongdoing, but by disallowing a small deduction from 6 years earlier, with penalty and interest, they came up with a tax bill of over $40,000. At the time, even with my legislative salary, I made far less than that a year. By the time I had completed the governor's race, various government agencies had me enmeshed in 7 separate audits. 4 years of personal tax return audits, one by the Federal Elections Commission for the Senate campaign, one by the state for the governor's race, and one for my own home parish for the governor's race. No criminal violations were alleged in any of the audits. The federal government found only 15 minor errors out of almost 50,000 individual contributions in my campaign for the U.S. Senate. The 15 donors had contributed slightly more than allowed. For instance, some had simply failed to note that the contribution was from both husband and wife, which would have made the amount acceptable. For these errors made by our staff while I was out campaigning, they personally fined me $20,000. More importantly, they tied up hundreds of hours of my time and practically bankrupted me in the process. I completed dealing with my personal audits in 1997. Despite these efforts directed against me, I just plowed ahead during my campaigns, but the public never knew of the difficulties I faced behind the scenes. As is true in my whole political life, the unfair tactics against me only stiffened my resolve. My personality is much like that of a child who becomes more defiant the more you strike him. I am aware that my authorship of this book will cause an extreme reaction around the world by the mortal enemies of our people. If not for my many good friends and supporters, I would find it hard to face the difficulties that I know are ahead. The next section is the governor's race. The next year's race for governor found my campaign more organized than we had been for the U.S. Senate campaign. We now had a statewide organization in place. I had beaten the incumbent governor in the tax amendment referendum and had come close to beating an 18-year incumbent U.S. senator. The field was crowded with 6 full-time, hard-working, and well-financed candidates. Unlike the Senate campaign, there were a number of televised debates which aired statewide. In spite of the character assassination I continued to endure from the press, my support had never been stronger. When the election night voting returns came in for the first primary, former Governor Edwards led slightly with 34%. I was only 1% behind at 33%, and Governor Romer trailed badly behind me at only 27%. Governor Romer had switched the Republican Party a few months before, trying to head off my candidacy, but I defeated the sitting governor, as well as the official Republican Party nominee, Congressman Clyde Holloway, and became the Republican candidate in the runoff against the archenemy of the party in Louisiana, the very liberal and corrupt Democrat Edwin Edwards. The same Times-Picayune that repeatedly railed against Edwards' corruption in his last term as governor suddenly did an about-face and told the people of Louisiana that he had changed completely and now simply wanted to be elected so he could redeem his sullied reputation. Corruption in the governor's chair meant little to the Times-Picayune compared to the ethnic interests of its owners. When it became obvious that most people did not believe in Edwards' miraculous change, Edwards supporters printed thousands of bumper stickers reading simply, "Vote for the crook. It's important." My opponents mobilized to defeat me as they never have in any other American election in history. The Jewish finance group spent millions of dollars from wealthy Zionists while my campaign had limited donations. As long as these groups spent ostensibly against a candidate rather than for a candidate, they were technically not beholden to the same campaign laws that I was. Edwards raised many millions of dollars and even spent $1.5 million on election day alone in a vote-buying program called voter hauling. In other strange procedures, the register of voters in some parishes actually went to the jails to register prisoners to vote, and in the final days even allowed them to vote in the election absentee. The Times-Picayune printed front-page editorials against me many days running called, quote, "The Choice of Our Lives," unquote. Suppose news articles read like editorials against me in all the major papers of the state. In violation of all military ethics and protocol, the head of the Louisiana National Guard went on television commercials in uniform to denounce me and urge people to vote against me. He also sent a letter, a political letter, opposing me to all the members of the Louisiana National Guard. Anti-David Duke TV and radio commercials were on at a ratio of at least 50 to 1 against me. Media advertising guru Raymond Strother said at the time, quote, "It has to be the largest single advertising buy ever in American politics against one man." By the way, all the documentation for these citations in my book are all in my hard copy, which you need to get and take a look at, which will give you a tremendous sense of the documentation we have here. But even after all that deluge of the best propaganda money could buy, and some that money could not buy, the election was still neck and neck. After the Senate campaign, the Jewish political experts finally figured out the only way they could beat me: economic blackmail. Jewish officers of national conventions, such as the American Medical Association, wrote letters to the public officials saying that they would cancel the Louisiana conventions at the cost of millions in Louisiana tourist and tax revenue if I were elected. The major newspapers did not simply report the blackmail tactics. They printed photocopies of the letters on their front pages in colorful graphic advertisements. Workers at plants got notices with their paychecks that if I were elected, the company would move from Louisiana and they would lose their jobs. Coaches of major sports teams, including Louisiana's popular basketball coach Dale Brown, warned that my election would damage their recruitment programs and damage all the university sports programs. It was said that a scheduled Super Bowl would not come to New Orleans. After the all-out assault on my character didn't work well enough, the Jewish extremists then made direct threats against the citizens of the state, effectively telling them that if Louisiana voted for me, they would ruin Louisiana and everyone in it. No major papers or media outlets in Louisiana even dared to criticize this orchestrated use of naked coercion and intimidation to control the outcome of an election. Seeking to find out how effective the blackmail campaign was going, I talked to friends at the United Cab Company, which at that time had only white drivers and who had lost two drivers who were murdered by black criminals in recent years. An earlier survey showed that over 90% of them voted for me in the U.S. Senate race and in the first primary. After the blackmail campaign had reached a crescendo, we found now that only 60% planned on voting for me. A few cab drivers told me that they had no choice but to vote for Edwards or lose their livelihood. Understanding that they were under that kind of pressure, I felt thankful and gratified that 60% voted for me in spite of the fact that they believed it would lead to financial hardship for their families. When the returns came in, even with the largest black turnout in the state's history and at more than 30% of the total votes, I still received almost 40% of the vote against Edwards. That meant that I had received about 60% of the white vote, perhaps even a little higher. In spite of the personal smears, having only a tiny fraction of the campaign advertisements, having all the newspapers and media against me, and even with the threat of economic ruin against them, white people voted for me in a landslide. Without the economic blackmail, I'm confident that I could have easily won the additional 15% of the white vote that I needed to win. I stayed with my supporters late into the campaign night. The hotel where we stayed had an election night party and had given me the presidential suite. At about midnight, I slipped into a steaming hot tub, too tired to feel much of anything after campaigning for 17 hours or better every day for almost 9 months. I shook at least 75,000 hands, gave 1,000 talks, wrote almost all the campaign literature, arranged for the advertising and the mailings. I was so exhausted. I fell asleep in the bubbling water, and when I awoke, the water was cold. I headed for the starch sheets and their cool escape from defeat. The next day, my friend Howie Farrell pointed out to me how ironic it is that whites, who are 70% of the state, did not get their overwhelming choice as governor of Louisiana, while blacks, at only 30%, got their choice. The Jewish media gloated that black voters had saved white voters from themselves. Because the governor's race and the legislative races are held at the same time, I could not run for re-election and governor at the same time. I served out my term in the legislature until the newly elected representatives took their seats in January. Not holding any current seat, I was free to take the message that I had successfully spread in Louisiana to the rest of the nation. My last two races showed that I had good support among the white voters, not only in Louisiana, but across America. Even though I was a long shot for the nomination, I decided to enter some of the Republican presidential primaries. Every public appearance gave me an opportunity to awaken more European Americans. I announced my candidacy at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., but decided to pass up the New Hampshire primary and concentrate on some of the southern primaries. One side effect of my entry to the race was to give Patrick Buchanan some much-needed breathing room. As much as the Jewish-dominated media distrusted Buchanan, in comparison to me, he seemed downright moderate. And a wide repeat of what I accomplished in Louisiana, they saved most of their venom for me and laid off Buchanan for a while. Then, when Buchanan scored well against George Bush in New Hampshire, it propelled his candidacy past mine. I cannot overemphasize that voters are equally concerned with a candidate's issues and his prospect of winning. Voters will more often than not vote for their second choice if they think that their first choice has little chance. For most people, politics is the art of the possible, not a pure expression of their preferences. I received respectable vote totals in a number of states, more votes, even with Patrick Buchanan in the race, than some candidates who are sitting United States senators and United States congressmen. But Buchanan's New Hampshire showing had shifted too much of my vote in subsequent primaries to him. I bowed out early, leaving the right wing of the party completely open to him. And despite his unkind remarks about me, I helped him as much as I could. After Buchanan negated my threat to the establishment, the Jewish press then descended upon him with the unbridled fury they had previously focused on me. In the 1996 primaries, a number of my supporters helped the Buchanan candidacy. In South Carolina, my South Carolina campaign coordinator in 1992, Dr. William Carter, became an officer in Buchanan's campaign. The media lambasted Buchanan for daring to have former Duke supporters in his campaign. In an ill-advised move, Buchanan kicked out every Duke supporter the press could find in his camp. The action weakened him among the ranks of many of his best supporters. He should have just responded to the press that to be elected president of the United States, you shouldn't be in the habit of telling people not to vote for you. In spite of Buchanan's disparagement of me, I still helped him in Louisiana Republican caucuses, and my dedicated supporters around the state were the major reason he won the Louisiana Republican primary. Although Buchanan leaves much to be desired, he was certainly the best candidate with a chance to win in 1996. I've always believed that we must put aside our personal considerations and do what's best for our race and nation, even though, in an attempt to deflect press criticism, he said some nasty things about me, and yet I still supported him. In the Louisiana Senate race in 1997, I entered a crowded field of six major Republican candidates and two major Democrats, and came in second among the Republicans behind Representative Woody Jenkins, who, much like Buchanan, got an early jump on me. The polls indicated that he had the best chance to avoid an all-Democratic runoff. I still ran strongly with 12% of the vote in a crowded field, even though I was outspent dramatically by all the other major candidates. All my electoral successes came from a team effort of capable individuals, such as my brilliant right-hand man for many years, Glenn R. Montesino, and many others who unselfishly gave of their time and countless hours of work. The entire Farrell family, Kenny Knight, Dr. Schubert, Laura Altilio, the Jeffesses, the Donahues, Raymond Scalco, Terry Sinn, Mark Ellis, the Touchstones, Dan Murphy, and many other wonderful supporters. I could never hope to name all those who deserve mention. I was elected to the Political Executive Committee of the St. Tammany Parish Republican Party in 1996. And then 8 months later, in a unanimous vote, the committee elected me as its chairman. During my tenure as head of the Republican Party in St. Tammany Parish, it became the first Republican Louisiana parish to have more registered Republicans than Democrats, and it has the largest number of Republicans of any parish in the state of Louisiana. I served as PEC chairman until the year 2000. As the only elected official in the entire United States who dares to tell the truth of race and Jewish supremacism, I continued to travel across America and the world, going wherever there are European peoples to speak to about the issues of vital importance to the survival of our heritage. The establishment's battle to suppress the truth goes on, but I find individual European Americans far more receptive than ever before our message of heritage, rights, and renewal. I traveled to South Africa and participated in broadcasts on Radio Free South Africa, encouraging the Europeans to stand fast in defense of the nation that they had built. In Russia, I met with many nationalist leaders, including Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Vladimir Zhirinovsky. I met with the Russian political leader and the party's offices in the Russian parliament. One of the most ominous aspects of contemporary times is an increasing tendency for both government and media to endorse and use methods of political suppression. On May 5, 1997, I had a speech scheduled in Tampa, Florida. Six meeting halls, including some public venues, were canceled after intimidation and threats of violence. The location where I finally spoke had to be kept secret to the last possible moment. In my talk, I noted that if I were a black elected official denied use of a public facility, there would have been an FBI civil rights investigation. The government would have used every resource at its disposal to prosecute and imprison those who use threats of violence to deny my civil rights. The supposed great defenders of the rights of freedom of speech, the press, did not defend my right to free speech. In fact, the largest and most prestigious paper in the area, the Tampa Tribune, actually applauded the fact that my supporters and I were denied our civil rights. An editorial stated, quote, "It's a sign of progress that six meeting halls turned down Duke when they tried to rent space for his speech." The federal government never prosecutes Marxists who have repeatedly attempted to deny my civil rights through violence and intimidation. In 1996, when I participated in the most covered public debate during the Anti-Affirmative Action Proposition 209 initiative in California, the communists rioted in an attempt to keep me from appearing. No one was charged with the conspiracy to deny my civil rights. In Cleveland in 1997, my supporters rented the Lithuanian Hall for me to give a speech. Marxists descended upon the facility, assaulted anyone daring to enter the hall, and then attacked the police for simply keeping the door clear. They threw chunks of concrete at us and broke in the large glass door to the facility. The city police in the melee arrested a number of the communists. The next day, the local newspaper headline read, quote, "Duke sparks riot." Anyone of my political persuasion who would have gone to a black civil rights meeting and physically assaulted the participants and violently damaged the facility would have been charged with federal conspiracy to deny civil rights. Of course, none of the communists faced even a federal investigation. Efforts to restrict freedom of speech and thought also continue in the increasing passage of so-called hate laws, where punishment is meted out according to the supposed thoughts in the mind of the offender. What George Orwell's classic book, 1984, referred to as thought crimes have become a reality at the end of the 20th century in America and in practically every European nation. The idea that one should be punished more severely because one does not like someone because of sexual orientation or race, as opposed to the limitless other motives for a crime, is ludicrous. When government decrees that a certain kind of thought in someone's mind is at the time of a crime is more punishable than another thought, that's the first step toward outlawing those thoughts and expressions of those thoughts altogether. In Canada, Australia, England, France, Germany, and most Western nations, such repression has already happened. In France, a citizen can go to jail for telling a friend in his living room that the convictions at the Nuremberg trials were unjust. Publishing a newsletter in England that dares to blame increased crime on third world immigration can land one in prison. In Switzerland or Germany, simply telling the truth that the gas chambers shown tourists at Auschwitz are fakes is punishable by imprisonment. Of course, these chambers that they show the tourists were reconstructions. They're not original, even though they're portrayed that way. I shall repeat this once more, so that no one can mistake what is happening. Men are in jail at this moment in a number of so-called free European nations for simply questioning the Jewish interpretation of. On the very morning that I write these lines, the Times-Picayune has an article stating that a Swiss author and his publisher were sentenced to more than a year in prison for simply publishing a book which alleged that the gas chambers shown to tourists at Auschwitz are fakes built after the war. And by the way, that's supported by videotaped comments by the chief curator of the camp, historian Dr. Francis Piper. You know, I, in this book, and I in my life, I spent a lot of time in Europe, I don't directly deny any Holocaust. But I can tell you one thing, that any sort of historical inquiry should be permitted, and the idea of putting people in prison for expressing their opinions, those people who try to put people in prison, they are the ones guilty of human rights violations, and they're the ones who should be put in prison, not people for expressing their own heartfelt and educated opinions. Whether or not one believes the author and his publisher are correct in their conclusions, it must be admitted that a truly free society does not imprison a man for stating an opinion about an historical event. Imprisoning these two men, by the way, and one of them, my very good and close friend, Jürgen Graf, who is basically in exile now outside of Switzerland. Imprisoning these men for expressing an unpopular opinion goes against the very basis of the United Nations Covenant of Human Rights. It goes against the Helsinki Accords. It goes against every principle of freedom of speech and press that the media and the civilized nations of the world supposedly uphold. Is not one of the proofs the media uses to argue the supposed evil of Nazism that the Nazis burned books? If such is proof of evil and tyranny, then what exactly is it when nations not only outlaw politically incorrect books, but also imprison their writers and even their publishers? An example of how crazy it has become in Western nations can be seen in another recent act by Swiss authorities. Jews around the world organized a vicious campaign against the Swiss in order to extort billions of dollars. Forcing the Swiss banks to capitulate, the Jews threatened to use their influence to close down Swiss banking and business affairs in nations all over the world, including the United States. A patriotic Swiss gentleman suggested that if the Jews boycott Switzerland, that in self-defense, the Swiss should boycott the Jewish commercial concerns and not vacation in Israel. He was convicted of fomenting racial hatred for simply advocating the very same thing that Jews did against the Swiss on a worldwide scale. It's a neat trick, extorting $1 billion from a nation and getting a law passed requiring that anyone who complains about it be thrown in prison. In America, hate crimes laws are the first steps towards similar draconian methods to prevent the truth from reaching the American people. Seaman Wiesenthal, the ADL, and others have begun a campaign to keep websites off the internet that simply expose Jewish supremacism, Israeli suppression of Palestinians, or the scientific facts of racial differences. They have already succeeded in outlawing such sites in Germany, France, Switzerland, and a number of other European nations. They have been behind software filters that block sites in schools, libraries, and homes that simply defend European-American rights and heritage. In some public libraries, if someone types in my website address, www.davidduke.com or duke.org, the inquiry is routed to a notice that my site is a, quote, hate site, and then the visitor is routed to an ADL homepage attacking me and others who dare to expose Jewish supremacism. I can completely understand the Jewish efforts to suppress freedom of speech, for suppression is the only way for them to prevent exposure of their lies. The revolution that will flow from the truth is the only thing that can upset messianic dreams of Jewish Zionist dominion and the genocidal final solution planned for our people. The truth, though, shall prevail only if we dare to speak it, to defend it, and to fight for it with intelligence and courage. The next chapter is chapter 41, An Aryan Vision.